For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we are in Daniel 7 and 8 tonight. Actually, we're going to take 2 weeks to study two chapters, but we're going to take them in one lump because they're related. And we're moving into a different kind of section in the book of Daniel. If you've been with us in our study up through chapter 6, you'll know that it's historical narrative. It's the story of Daniel and his buddies who are living in Babylonian captivity. And it's the story of how they remain faithful to God during that time. It's an awesome study of just faithfulness and what does it look like to trust God in difficult circumstances. And now, with that basic timeline, Daniel has spent really his entire adult life in Babylon. He went in 605 BC. He is still recounting events in his life as far as 537 BC. So for quite a number of years, Daniel's been in there and telling us what's been going on. And what has been going on is that during this time, and where you have emperor after emperor, he's gone through three Babylonian emperors. And then as we studied last time, a new empire comes, the Medo-Persian Empire under Cyrus, the great Persian leader. And he serves as well under Cyrus and Darius the Mede. During this huge expanse of time, this many decades, this 60 plus years that Daniel has been living in captivity, God has been active in Daniel, revealing to him visions and dreams of what will come to pass in the future. And so now this is what we're going to be studying from this point on. Let's take the context in chapter 7, verse 1. It says, "The first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. And then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it." So that's what's going on here. The first year of Belshazzar's reign, so we have a specific date for that, which we'll talk about in a minute. And the fact that Daniel saw dreams and visions. There have been a lot of dreams and visions in the book of Daniel up to this point. Oddly, those dreams and visions have been in the Babylonians' experience, and that Daniel and his friends have been there to interpret those things for them. But now the whole thing is going to shift, and the rest of the book of Daniel is about the way that God has revealed through dreams and visions and various things what is going to happen in the course of human history from this point on till the very end of history. And so this is what we call predictive prophecy. The idea that God stands outside of time. He's able to look at the whole span of history, and he is able in one moment to kind of encompass in his awareness the whole thing. And so as a consequence, he's able to affect his plan that he has within human history, and he's able to disclose to people where it's all going. And so this ends up being something very distinctive about the God of the Bible, and very distinctive about biblical faith, that God has a plan, that he is working his plan in history, because he is, as we've been reading in Daniel, he is the Lord of heaven. And as the Lord of heaven is the absolute final authority behind all things, and as the final authority behind all things, the knower of all things, he is able to affect his plan for humanity, and then he calls his people to be his witnesses that he has spoken these things and that they have come to pass. And so we find passages like this in Isaiah where it says, "Remember," and then he says, "Recall," and then again, "Remember." And so you can see Isaiah just, you know, guys, this is really important and so important that you are the ones that I've called upon to say, "I heard it, I was there, I knew that that was what God said." And what is it that he says? He says, "I am God, there is no other. I'm God and there is no one like me, declaring the end from the beginning. And from ancient times, things that have not yet been done, saying, my purpose will be established. I've planned it. Surely I will do it. So here's the uniqueness of the God of the Bible. He's not a stick of wood that you put on an altar and burn incense to, or whatever way that you might conceive of a God and then worship that God. The God of the Bible is the one who declares in terms that you and I can understand, hey, this is where it's all going. This is the future. And that is very important. That's evidence that what God says about himself and what God says about us can be trusted, that it is factual, that it is reliable, that we can place the weight of our faith in the things that he said, because he is disclosing to us information that is impossible for anyone other than God to possess. So it's very important to the life of the faith of God's people to understand that there is this God. And so why should we care? I think it's pretty evident. God wants us to know. He wants us to know where the whole thing's heading. He wants us to know what he's about. He doesn't want us to be in the dark. He wants to reveal himself to us in personal terms, in personal ways, in terms of our own experience of him. Yes, that's right. But more than that, more than the relational and the subjective, he wants to reveal himself also and leave behind him an objective record that when our feelings ebb and flow, when our closeness to God comes and goes, we can turn to the objective things that God has absolutely said and which he has kept his word on and which have come to pass in history. And we can say, man, I can put my faith there. That's a foundation that I can rely on. See, so God is envisioned in the scriptures as one who pursues. He wants us to know. He wants to draw us into relationship with him. And for that reason, has really been careful to detail for us who he is, what he's about, and how he's moved in history right down to your life here tonight. So these are the themes, then, that we're going to be talking about over the next several weeks. We're going to take about 6 more weeks of studying the book of Daniel, and we're going to get into these incredible themes, these incredible predictions about the future. I think that if you are with us in this study, whether you are a Christian here tonight or a spiritual seeker, an investigator, you're going to be confronted with some things that will be extremely important to the formation of the kind of faith that will carry you through the rest of your life. I just urge you and challenge you here tonight. Man, approach God. He exists. Ask him, hey, God, so help me get an understanding of what this stuff is all about. I am interested in hearing from you. I'm interested. I will respond if I am able to be convinced by these things. And I think what we'll find is that God, in his way, meets us as we think through these things and brings to us a real level of confidence that this is so. So that's my prayer for you. That's what I've been praying here for weeks as we've been meeting together. Now we're at that real critical place where we're going to really move into the hard data of God who knows the future. Well, this raises, of course, the obvious question, how can we interpret the things that are written? And you're going to find, actually, as we have already, some of the things that God writes about the future, these dreams and visions and stuff, some of that stuff's really wild, really weird, and we wonder, how can we really interpret it? And so we may, you know, think about this and like a Rorschach test and say, you know, what does that mean? Well, I can tell you with great confidence exactly what that means. Did you know that this is actually a picture of two men locked in combat with one another, their heads coming together, inspired as they are by crab-like gods over each of their shoulders and impish kinds of gods nipping at their backside? And that's what that is. Oh, thank you very much. Oh, thank you very much. you say. Oh, come on. I don't see that. I see the Eiffel Tower with a couple of Frenchmen walking down the Champs-Élysées, which isn't really where the Eiffel Tower is. But anyway, that's how I think a lot of us think about the idea of prophecy. It's just like, you know, sort of an acid trip kind of thing where you just kind of define your own reality through your experience. What does it mean to you? Well, I guess that's sort of up to you. But that is absolutely not the case, and this is very important. I'm going to lay out some principles here. We're going to come back to these principles every week that we're studying Daniel. They're very important because I want us to understand not only what is being said, but how did we get to that place to understand it? Okay? So there are basically five things in terms of ways of looking at these texts that we need to have in mind. The first is that the meaning of these visions and dreams, odd as they absolutely are actually interpreted within the framework of the prophecy itself. It's very important. Daniel will be wondering after having received the vision, what does this mean? And God will send his little messenger on down and he will get interpretation of what does it mean. So that's very important. It's not just, here are these weird images, and hey, what does it mean to you? Here's what it means to me. No, the text itself tells us what do these things mean. So that's important. Second, within the book of Daniel, we'll find that there is extraordinary continuity. The way this book is laid out just brings it all together. We find the visions of Daniel starting with Nebuchadnezzar's vision at the very beginning in Daniel chapter 2, where he dreams of four world kingdoms. That sets more or less the theme for the way the rest of the book is laid out. And so when we come to chapter 7 in the beginning of Daniel's dreams and visions, it more or less fits with it right within that framework. So just as Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of four kingdoms. Remember the statue there made up of the different materials, the gold and silver and bronze and iron. So Daniel, in the passage that we're going to look at here in just a minute, also has a dream of four kingdoms, but considered from a different angle, namely from God's perspective. So it isn't a beautiful statue. It's four frightening, grotesque animal-type images. But it carries that same theme of the four kingdoms. In chapter 8, which we'll also look at, two of those four kingdoms are singled out for more specific analysis. Then in chapter 9, the most amazing text in Daniel, maybe ever written by a human pen, Daniel chapter 9, where he charts out the exact time that the Messiah is going to enter into the world scene. Wow! And we're going to talk about that in a few weeks. And then in chapters 10 through 12, the very last of the four kingdoms is expanded, and the prelude then, the foundation is set for the return of God to establish his kingdom on the earth. So that's how all of these things are going to work together. We'll see it as we go. Then thirdly, we're going to be very interested in the confirmation of these prophetic messages by history outside the Bible itself, and where we will be able to correlate very clearly and very naturally, here is what the prophecy is saying, and here is what we know as a matter of fact about the ancient world and the fulfillment of these things. And we'll see an example of that here tonight. That's really kind of astounding. We're also going to look at the fact that to interpret these passages, we want to look at them within the framework of the Old Testament as a whole. And so really what Daniel's doing is he is extending a story about God and what God is doing in human history that goes all the way back to the book of Genesis. And so in Daniel's discussions and Daniel's visions and how he lays them out in his book, he very freely connects with the Old Testament book of Jeremiah, for example, the book of Leviticus, the idea of a king and a kingdom that comes out of 2 Samuel chapter 7 and is reflected on by the Psalms. And so what we find in these visions of Daniel is that much of what the Old Testament's picture is just all comes together about what God is going to do for the future. Man, we're going to get into this in a huge way in part two of our study of chapter 7 and 8. So we'll come back to that next time. Then lastly, too, we want to talk about the relationship of these visions to the Bible as a whole. And what we'll begin to realize is that when Jesus spoke of his return, he casts that in Matthew 24 and in places like that, very much in the language and concepts of these visions that come from the book of Daniel. When we come to the book of Revelation, at the close of God's communication with humanity through his word, all of this, the language and the imagery of Daniel comes out as though God is saying, that's the next step. The next thing here is to anticipate the end of human history and of my return. And so we're going to see how all that stuff gets connected. It's a beautiful thing. It's a powerful thing. It's the one thing that I have found as I've studied the Bible these 35 years now in a pretty systematic way. The thing that has really, more than anything, communicated to me the thought that there is a God and that God does speak is the nature of these prophetic statements and how over the course of hundreds of years in different geographical places and different historical circumstances, even in using different languages, the biblical authors are absolutely reading completely off the same page about who is God, about where is history going, and they're just tracking it. And it is amazing, and it is very convincing proof that what God says about himself in his word is absolutely true. So let's just dive in then. Let's take a look. He says, this is chapter 7, verse 2. I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it. See what I mean by weird? That's pretty weird. Then he goes on, behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, arise and devour, eat much meat. After this, I kept looking, and behold, another beast, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Wow. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. And it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Okay, shall we pray? Ready to go. What does this mean? This is some weird stuff. Let's think about this. While I was contemplating, he says, the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the four horns were pulled out by the roots. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. So this concludes this first vision. And we ask the question then, well, how can we make sense out of this? What does it mean? How do we interpret it? Well, let's go back to our principles. Look, verse 17. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will rise from the earth. But the true believers of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all the ages to come. What do those four grotesque beasts represent? Four kingdoms. How do we know that? Because it says so. We don't have to wonder. And that's very important. Within the text itself, we understand that Daniel is getting these visions of these creatures that represent four kingdoms. And that also, of course, when we think of the framework of the book of Daniel itself, fits very well with what we've already seen from chapter 2. Remember that Nebuchadnezzar had the same kind of a dream of four kingdoms that represented four materials out of which this statue is made. Specifically, Babylon is mentioned as the first one. And then there are three that would come after, the fourth of which, the last of which, represents the final human kingdom before God himself comes to rule on the earth. Okay, so we see, and every interpreter, every critic of the book of Daniel, of which there are many, Jewish and Christian and agnostic, they all agree that these two visions, the one in chapter 2 and one in chapter 7, really are saying exactly the same thing, but from different vantage points. Everyone agrees that this is the case because the language of the text is so straightforward and so clear. There's no mystery. From the human perspective, four great kingdoms that reflect the greatness that is man. That's what Nebuchadnezzar saw. Daniel sees something else. He sees something of the sinister side of human nature from God's perspective, which is that these empires that rise up are just like wild beasts that come and devour and destroy everything that comes in front of it. Anything that it wants, it takes, and it takes by violence. And that's God's take on history as far as what humans are capable of doing. Now, so here's the correspondence then. The statue and the beasts. And so the flying lion. I actually have a bas relief of the eagle-winged lion in my office. I have a friend who was in what is today Turkey, and he rubbed it off of a monument inscription from this period. It's really quite remarkable that that image is there, and it does represent Babylon. And then there's a second kingdom, the bear, a third kingdom where you got the four wings, and then the final kingdom with the weird 10 horns, and that is some artist's take on what does that really look like. Now, let's press on. We're going to look in chapter 8 now at another vision, then we're going to bring some things together. It says, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, and we talked about him a couple of weeks ago, a vision appeared to me subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. In other words, so 2 years later, after he had this dream of the four beasts, 2 years later he has another vision, and this is described in these terms. He says, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of a canal. Now, the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, coming up last. So its head was kind of like tilted because it was heavy. He says, I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue him from his power. But he did as he pleased and magnified himself. Imagine that. Then it says, while I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without even touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes. He came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and he rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And the goat hurled the ram to the ground and trampled on him, and there was no one to rescue him. Wow. Then the goat magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. In other words, the four directions on the earth is what that's a reference to. Okay, here's a strange vision, right? And our question is, what does it mean? How do we interpret this? And so, just like with the earlier dream or vision in chapter 7, We can look right into the text itself. It says in verse 20, "The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia." Now remember, when Daniel is writing this, he's writing this under the reign of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Belshazzar, as we've studied him, is the last king of Babylon. He is going to be overrun and destroyed. His kingdom will end because the Persians, the Medo-Persians, will take that over. The shaggy goat, he says, represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn between the eyes is its first king. The broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms arising from his nation, although not with his power. Do you see how things are getting a little bit more specific now? Do you see how the story of history is moving now into the future and into a place where way beyond Daniel's historic experience, it ends, and these visions continue on in very specific detail? We know from the context, from what's within the text itself. We don't have to ask, what is the ram? What is the goat? What do they mean? What do they mean to you? I think they mean, you know, that the UN's going to take over the world, or, you know, whatever. No, it says specifically that they relate to two kingdoms that arise in the ancient world, the Medo-Persian and the Greek kingdom. And when we look within, again, the framework of the book of Daniel, it fits right in the context of chapter 7 and chapter 2, those visions that we've already talked about. So you see the thing is really filling out here. And so in chapter 8, the ram represents Persia, it says so. The male goat represents Greece, it says so. And then there's this final kingdom, again, which is not talked about in chapter 8, but it is in chapter 7. And that gives us then that whole framework then that this is where human history is going. And it's going to be guided by these powers. Three are known and one is not named, but which we'll describe in considerable detail when we get to our study of that in chapter 11 and 12. So you're just going to have to hold off for that. Let's talk about what we can know and do know. That Daniel is here before there even was any kind of a Greek empire or Greek expansionism at all. In the 6th century BC, Daniel is predicting the emergence of the Greek Empire and the falling of the Medo-Persian Empire, which, when Daniel's writing this, did not even control Babylon. So this is kind of an amazing little piece of knowledge that he has come to, that God has revealed to him, which also, and this is our third principle, and this is kind of an interesting one, is confirmed by known history. Okay, let's think about this here just for a second. The kingdom of Greece, it says very specifically here. Well, Alexander conquered the ancient Near East after a battle in 333 BC, the Battle of Granicus. The Persian army was effectively defeated, and from that place, Alexander moved right into Palestine, modern-day Israel, and met those who had moved, who had migrated back to Jerusalem to rebuild the city. And of that, there is really no historical question whatever. And interesting to note, Josephus, the Roman historian of the 1st century, whose historical method and his grasp of the facts of the ancient world are really the basis for our knowledge of this whole area and this whole point in time. Again, he's just absolutely respected as the greatest historian of his day in this place. Well, Josephus records a very interesting event that happened when Alexander showed up in Jerusalem in 332 BC. And it goes like this. He says, when the book of Daniel was showed him, where Daniel declared that one of the Greeks would destroy the Persians, Alexander supposed that he himself was the person intended. And so he granted all that the Jews requested of him. Now think about it, okay? Think about this. This is not the Bible. This is secular history recounting an event that Daniel, 200 years before this event, described that a king would raise up from Greece, a great man, and he would just utterly slaughter the Medo-Persian Empire, which he did. And then when he shows up in Jerusalem, the people there who had the copy of Daniel's text went out there and said, "Hey, funny thing, we've been expecting you because our God told us 200 years ago that this is exactly what was going to go down." And this blew Alexander's mind. And this, if you think about it, ought to blow your mind. Okay, because this is historical confirmation. Not disputed. This is not, you know, again, this is not, what are those tabloid things called? The Weekly World News, you know. This is not Elvis coming in a spaceship or Bat Boy, you know, shows up in the Persian Gulf War or something like that. It's a great story, but happens not to be true. This is a serious historian recording an event that absolutely did happen in direct fulfillment of words that God gave in specific detail 200 years before they happened. That's what this is. We're witnessing the confirmation outside the Bible of the truth of the prophetic record. That's what that is. See, Daniel, there's no way, writing as he does in the 530s BC, there's no way Daniel could ever have conceived of a Greek empire that was stronger than the empire that had not yet arisen to destroy the empire that he was a part of in Babylon. Could not have happened. We know a lot about the Greeks of the 6th century BC. And most of it is that they're fighting with each other. The Spartans and the Athenians are going at it, and the whole Peloponnesian League thing isn't really working out, and they're bankrupting each other with their wars, and they're dying of plagues, and they're taking over some islands here and there. But the thought that this would be an empire that seriously challenged the Persians would be completely a laughable absurdity. It would be like me saying, in 200 years, Bolivia will be the most, you know, the greatest power on earth. You know? Just like, really? Yeah. Well, no, not really. But that's the point here. And I want us to understand that. Some people have tried to argue, as we've talked about when we started our study, that Daniel is just pious forgery. His predictions are so specific that he could not possibly have been writing these things before they happened. Because why? Because such knowledge is impossible for a man to have. That's why. Well, that's part of the truth. It is impossible for a man to have, but it's not impossible for God to have or for God to reveal. And so there is a very important piece of this. We know that Daniel was written before the events that it describes relating to the Greek kingdom. Why? Because the historian describing those very things presumes that it's true. It's not made up. It's not some kind of patriotic fiction written after the facts to show, isn't our God really cool? It's not possible because the Jewish people of Alexander the Great's day had the book of Daniel and presented it to him. And then lastly here, Alexander's empire, just as Daniel described it, you got the big horn in the middle, But the horn gets snapped off, and out of that comes four other horns, four other kingdoms, right? Remember that? Well, that's exactly, of course, what happened. And Alexander, after having defeated the Persians, dies unexpectedly and very young and without an heir. And he, in his 30s, you know, it's amazing. He conquered the world from modern-day India to North Africa, all of the Middle East, Southern Europe, North Africa. His kingdom was expansive and amazing. And he conquered it in just a number of years and was able to hold on to it. But he died. And so he left his kingdom to four generals, and who just divided up the kingdom. And we're going to return to one of those, the Seleucid kingdom, later when we get into chapter 11. But again, this is just exactly how Daniel described it. The great conquering Greek will be cut off, and four others will come and take his kingdom. Again, it's exactly what happened. So there are some things for us to think about here. Why should we care about these things? You're scratching your head saying, is this a history class? What is this? Who cares? Think about it. Look, if God has spoken, if God has described in detail events that would take place hundreds of years before they took place, that someone, even if they're a great, you know, guesser of trends and the way things are going, could never have possibly imagined, but describes with specific detail the emergence of the empires that would come after him, the Persian Empire and the Greek Empire, and we know that he's writing before these events take place, then we have to make some decisions about this. We can't be neutral about this. Some people say, you know, well, I guess I'd believe in God if he, like, you know, showed up in my house and wrote his name on the wall. Oh, wait a minute. He did that once. That didn't work out so well for Belshazzar. I'd believe in God if, you know, what's the if? Come on. Some of us here are thinking, you know, I would really be serious about my walk with God if what? How about if he demonstrated objectively, historically, that what he says he means and what he predicts will come to pass? How about that? How about that? And so, you know, we've got to reconcile. We can't just look at this and say, that's just really interesting. I'm so glad you shared that with me. You know, what we are looking into here is the mind of God revealed to you. It's not just interesting. And God, then, you know, he's going to draw us into that place where we have got to decide, on what ground do I stand? God has revealed these things to me, and what will I do with that? Just to say, well, my decision is I make no decision. Well, that's a decision, isn't it? It means that I sit in the proverbial seat of the scoffer and say, not interested, not enough. And God is, like, really not impressed by that. See, it's reasonable to believe in the things that God promises and the things that we cannot yet confirm historically, based upon the things that he has already done that we can confirm historically. And that's the way prophecy works. Predictions are made. Amazing predictions are made. Those things come to pass. it then becomes reasonable to believe that here's a person in contact with information that no human being could have. This has to come from God. And so that's the way it works. Let's take a look at this. In verse 9, going back to chapter 7, this is where we're going to end our study tonight. He says, I kept looking until the thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming from before him. Thousands were attending to him, and myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were open. Then he says, I kept looking into the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like the Son of Man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. All the peoples, nations, and people of every language serve him. His rule is everlasting. It will not pass away, and his kingdom will never be destroyed. Now, that is something that has not yet taken place. But what is he talking about here? What is this? It's the ending of history summed up in two realities. Two things that are as sure to come down as that there was a Greek conquest of the Persians in 333 BC. One of them is that the books, he says, were open. That yes, there is justice in the universe. That there will be justice restored to the broken and fallen and rebelliousness of humankind. And there will come a time where God says, enough of the exercise of your freedom to brutalize each other. I'm calling an end to it, and I'm going to bring all people to stand before me in judgment. Oh yeah. The Bible's very clear on this point. New Testament, Old Testament, speak with one voice. This is how it will end, just as surely as these kingdoms that were predicted by Daniel came to pass. We will stand each before a holy God to give account for what did I do with these things that you showed me, what did I do with the injustice in my own heart and in my own hands? And to steal a page from our study next time, which we're going to get into in some detail, this is just such an amazing little passage. The hope of Daniel, as we will see, is that grace, the goodness of God, the mercy of God will triumph over his judgment. Because why? Because the Son of Man, who Daniel describes here, the Son of Man, who is his God's only Son, Jesus Christ, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom. For who? For you. For you. See, because like these grotesque animals described in Daniel's visions, the heart of all of us as human beings is grotesque. It is corrupt. It is collapsed in on itself and self-absorbed and distorted for that reason. And we are in way over our heads before the Lord, the sovereign of history, to whom we will give account. And Daniel looks forward to the Son of Man, who is 90 times in the New Testament referred to as Jesus Christ. He is the Son of Man. And it is he who will take upon himself in his own body the judgment of God reserved for people who are far from him, sinful people like you and me. That is where history's going. That's what it's all about. It's going to the cross. And God then just presents to you, on the authority of what he has revealed in history, the option of standing before him with the books open and in judgment, or to stand before him covered by the atoning sacrifice of his own Son, the Son of Man. That his death is your death. And then he's calling on you. You decide. You make a decision. If you want this mercy, ask for it. That's all you have to do. I want this to apply to me. God will not deliver us from our pride and make that choice for us. It's something that we must all make. How about you? How about you? Have you made that choice to stand under the sovereign God on the basis of his mercy in Jesus Christ? Just call out to him. You ask him. That's how I want to stand before you. And then we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the other part of this too, that the Son of Man rules, that his dominion is forever, it says. A kingdom that knows no end. A time of justice and peace on the earth. And that's where it's all going. And history will conclude with every knee bowing and every tongue confessing that Jesus is the Lord to the glory of the Father. Where it's all heading. And so we've gotten just one little piece of that here tonight. One piece. And we're going to see, just as significant and astonishing as this is, we're going to see other dimensions of the visions that Daniel receives, just as specific, just as amazing. And we're going to build this cumulative case that, man, God has spoken with pristine clarity about what the whole thing is about. And I just find that so strengthening to my faith. And I think maybe you will as well as we get into it.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.